One, two, three, four.
What influence do billionaires have on politics, journalism, and the technology that shapes our lives? What drives people to seek absolute power, and how can we hold them accountable?
Psychiatric Tales, The Age of Selfishness and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Cunningham is also well known for his comic strips, which have been featured on the websites Forbidden Planet and Activate Collective, among others. His more recent work includes a graphic novel on Elon Musk titled Elon Musk, Investigation into a New Master of the World.
Dale Cunningham, welcome to The Creative Process.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me.
Yes, so we're so excited to speak with you about your work as a graphic novelist, but you know, your most recently published book, which just came out here in France, Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and Twitter, you know, touches on so many important questions. We've just had the elections in the US. So many people are questioning the power of billionaires and the influence they have on media companies or the way we receive news and algorithms. So, you know, first, just tell us a little bit about the evolution, because you've been interested in these questions for a long time, right?
Yeah, very much since about 2008, when the banking crisis happened. And it seemed to me that the media was doing quite a poor job of explaining what the causes of the banking crisis were. So I investigated that. I was doing a book more or less to explain to myself, as much as a reader, what the cause of the banking crisis was. So a book called Super Crash came out of that, which is called The Age of Selfishness in the United States. And from that, I got interested in finance generally. And I moved on then to a book called Billionaires, which has just sort of three portraits of billionaire class, really. It looks at Jeff Bezos, the Koch brothers, who are oil and gas billionaires, and Rupert Murdoch. So each had a sort of different area, media, tech, and of course, oil and gas. So it seemed to me that I was covering pretty much everything by looking at those three. And that has led on to me writing books about Putin. And I consider him as being part of the billionaires class, because unofficially, he might actually be the richest person in the world, and not Elon Musk, because it's impossible to know how much wealth he actually has. Essentially, anything in the Russian economy belongs to him. So I wrote a book about that. And then it seemed a natural thing to do, to write a book about Elon Musk after that. So one thing led to the other, really.
Indeed. I've heard some comments, I think it was even by Elon Musk, that, oh, can you be wealthy if you don't have access to a standing army? So that's what you're talking about with Putin, that he has his oligarchs and the ones who are in favor and out of favor. So it's really hard to quantify that. You know, just going to your Elon Musk book, you end on a very harrowing note, or thinking about this long-termism that a lot of the billionaires coming out of Silicon Valley subscribe to. And it kind of puts them off the hook for making short-term decisions that benefit people currently alive on the planet.
They're thinking, some of them, thousands or millions of years in the future, you know, when none of us will be alive. Just to define for those who aren't familiar with long-termism, it's, in short, the ethical view that improving the long-term future of humanity is a key moral priority, which that part I agree with, but it's the how far in the future they are looking is often focusing on preventing existential risks over thousands or millions of years. And so a critique of that is that it could deprioritize the urgent present-day issues we face, like poverty and climate change, in favor of these speculative future concerns.
That kind of thinking lets them off the hook from actually making the planet viable. It allows them to accumulate wealth and make these decisions that really benefit themselves and this kind of imagined future population. So it's a kind of strange thing to get your head around when I think about that long-termism view. But definitely we have, you talk about Putin, or we talk about billionaires and this class of tech moguls who really have too much power, not just the wealth, but they have too much power. So in your research process, I'm just curious about what that was, but what were you surprised to find? What were some of the things that you admire about Elon Musk and some of these other billionaires? And what are some ways that we can really hold this power in check?
Well, I found this as well when I was looking at Rupert Murdoch, especially looking at their early life, and Jeff Bezos as well, is what you can admire is the incredible drive to do things. And that's admirable in itself, and the courage to sort of think beyond what regular people would think about. And that too, is admirable. And I admire the sort of vision, like, for example, Walt Disney wasn't a particularly good cartoonist. He didn't actually sit down, do any drawing. His was a vision that allowed all these incredibly creative people to work within his company to do all the amazing things that they did. And Elon Musk, in many ways, is that kind of person. He's not particularly a good scientist, not particularly a good engineer. He's a reasonably good businessman, but he also has an incredible vision that allows very creative people to do a lot of interesting things. A bit like Disney, he tends to also take credit for things that he didn't actually originate. So, yeah, there are good things about these people, but also often the dark things eclipse any good that they do. And certainly with Elon Musk helping Donald Trump get the Fed presidency and thus threatening democracy in the United States certainly outweighs any good that he's ever done in his life.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that because he's touted Twitter X as being the public square and he's supposed to be for freedom of speech, but then we've seen when the freedom of speech goes against him and likewise with Trump, then very suddenly he's not for freedom of speech.
It's freedom of speech for the right. They want the right to be abusive and oppressive without consequences. If you speak out against something, the people have the right to speak back, and that they're trying to quash as well.
And so you spoke about, I mean, of course, it even goes back before Murdoch, but I think that Murdoch brought it to a new level. So what kind of things did they take from a playbook from Murdoch or in the ways of influencing politics? How is it a different level of threat?
Because, of course, those are news organizations and things like Twitter X are not. If you could perhaps contrast that, because with the Washington Post, it still has journalistic standards, but in the Twitter sphere, there's no accountability.
Murdoch has been always the sort of most malign influence on democracy on the planet. So in this country, the UK, the US, Australia, in the past, before the internet age, certainly newspapers set the tone of the conversation, really. And politicians were certainly frightened of getting on the wrong side of him. But it's like Elon Musk and others, Peter Thiel and other billionaires, have really taken it up to another level, really, where they're interfering in politics directly, often with massive contributions of money. And this is one of the things that's gone wrong in the United States. They've basically allowed too much dark money to come into politics. So basically, politicians and entire parties can be bought outright and be owned, it seemed, by super rich billionaires. And that's obviously very anti-democratic, anti-free speech, anti-anything that's good, unless you're in that very, very top rich class of people. And even there, you can see them all sort of worried about their position. Many of them have recently, like Jeff Bezos, refused to get behind any particular politician because he didn't want to affect his business. He's basically backed Trump by not being against him.
Exactly. Although I would say, in contrast, I do believe that the Washington Post does seem to have some of those standards.
With the actual paper, there are obviously good reporters who are still trying to do good work.
Yeah, of course. You know, I'm glad that the Washington Post is propped up or that there are newspapers like the New York Times and, of course, The Guardian. And there are a handful of these national papers or news organizations. But Nicholas Kristof told me, and I hadn't realized, that more journalists have lost their jobs than, like, say, coal miners. They always say, oh, those jobs are, you know, antiquated. But in order to have a thriving democracy, we need to have a thriving fourth estate. So it's sad. I mean, I like that people are feeling empowered, but we need these fact checkers because we've seen what's happened when news devolves to rage to engage, opinions over facts, rushes to judgment without analyzing things, critical thinking. All these things are under threat, as you know, driven by the algorithms that reward anger when you strive for dopamine hits and these kind of things that keep you on the platforms longer. Democracy and journalism suffers.
That's absolutely true. And everything you say is quite horrible. And the trouble is I've, and many other people have no idea how to stop it or make things better, really. And I've been a very good recorder of bad things. But I'm starting to think now I should start doing a book that really sets out some kind of principles of things that we can actually do that are positive, that can fight for free speech and democracy. So that's something I've been thinking about lately, how I would go about doing that. Because it's easy enough to list all the things that are wrong, but you really need something to counter that.
Exactly. I think, you know, I've seen movements where they're championing kindness, championing the good works that are being done by NGOs as well, or NGOs in partnerships with journalists, because that's another way that can prop up journalism. And I think that all these other kinds of writing, we should say, you illustrate these very serious topics with your artwork. And I think that that's also a way to reach a broader audience who might be a little bit disenchanted with news organizations that are kind of stoking anger. And so you just bring these facts across, you illustrate it in a way that makes them memorable, and I think digestible, easily shareable in segments or in the whole. And I think that that's kind of veering towards that positivism, like the learning process, because we know that not everyone takes in information or stories through words. You know, they listen to them like podcasts, or the illustrations help bring home the facts in a way that, like, it leads towards something positive and bringing things out to the world in a tangible, concrete way. That's, I think, really important as the learning process.
Well, the beautiful thing about comic strips is that they're very, very accessible. One of my favorite comic strips is a daily news comic strip called Nancy, done by a cartoonist called Ernie Bushmiller. And it used to be basically a four-panel strip, maybe three, and it would be just a little bit of a setup and then a punchline. And what they used to say about Nancy was that by the time you've decided not to read it, you've already read it. So I try to take the same approach to not make the pages too complicated, make it easy to read. So the information sort of pours into you almost without you really realizing. It's like when you're reading a book and you're not even aware that you're turning the pages, but you're just fully in the story. And that's what I try to do, really. So I always do a sort of 6-panel layout on the page so you don't have to worry too much about where to look, where people are standing. It's all very simple and a subdued color palette. And all that, you can put as much technical information in the text as you want, really, because you don't have to dumb down with comic strips. You've got two streams of information, the visual stream and the actual text language as well. And the beautiful thing about that is you've got this really rich medium to work with.
Yeah, and it helps, I think, externalize certain concepts and kind of pull them apart. And I'd also read that you said that your influences include Gustav Klimt and Egon Schiele and George Grosz and some of these artists that were great at making social commentary, but artists that you might not associate with, not all of them anyway, with the graphic novel.
Absolutely, I will. I went to art college, so I was thrown into art history, if you like, and one of my big influence is a guy called Franz Masuriel, who was a Belgian woodcut artist who did basically whole novels in sort of one-page just woodcuts. So they were almost, but not quite, comic strips. Very stark, very black and white, like woodcuts. And that was an influence on my early work.
I don't know if you prefer the term art illustrated, you know, storytelling.
I'm a bit uneasy about graphic novelist because I still think of myself as a cartoonist, really. Even though people associate that with children's comics and superheroes and that. But it's a long tradition, cartooning, so I'm very happy with that. I've been stereotyped in doing nonfiction. This is what publishers want, so I've been doing that. But if I can, I would like to go back to doing fiction as well.
Well, now the nonfiction or the real world are now in the United States with the reality precedent. It's surreal to a level that you almost can't invent, so.
Yeah, you can't predict what's going to happen next. Predicting is impossible. And also, just the strangeness of the times that we live in. As you say, there's a surreal edge to it.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, you know, there's always this interplay between the image and the words and the story and the intention and the backstory. And you really unfold the life of Elon Musk and then his parents and grandparents even. And just that whole thread is interesting. But, you know, on this note of the interplay between image and language, I wonder what other insights it might give about propaganda, you know, as you're pairing the words with the images that can be a simplified essence. What has that taught you about politics and propaganda and persuasion?
Well, I know the CIA used to use comics to push their ideology in South America and places like that. And certainly there's a strong tradition as well on the religious right in America of using little chapbooks to get across messages to children. It worked very well as propaganda. But of course, I'm not trying to do propaganda. What I'm trying to do is root it in the truth as much as I possibly can. So everything I do is always backed up and referenced very closely to the source as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because you've also written about Ayn Rand and another influential figure who we've seen influence some of these tech figures. But yeah, they are larger than life characters. Definitely there's a huge amount of strangeness in all their lives. I was surprised to learn some of those things about Elon Musk in terms of the story of his father being abusive, but he's coming from wealth. But there's always this sense of adventurism with aviation, like going back to his maternal grandfather. And this part I can say I admire. It's funny because if I admire, you know, the electric car, that's not done by him alone, but he's bringing people together. That's for the good. We have a popular environmental podcast. So anything that's towards electrification or helps bring about the renewable energy transition. So he was a disruptor there, but then we also see his disruption with Twitter X, you know, that I'm not in favor of. I believe in the values of democracy and I don't like to see too much influence in anyone's hands.
But just stick to doing what he was doing with electric cars and making space transport cheaper. That is genuinely revolutionary. SpaceX achieved creating rockets that could be reused, going into space, coming back, landing so they could be refitted again and sent off. That is an amazing technical feat. But it's not just Elon Musk who did that. He hired the right people. All the incredibly brilliant engineers he hired to work on that. So let's not forget who is responsible for achieving that. If only he could have stuck to those technical things and worked a little bit, helped the planet. But what he's been doing in the past 5 years especially, has been incredibly damaging to democracy and therefore the rest of the world as well. Because we've got these multiple crises. We've got ecological collapse. We've got climate change. There's a potential for nuclear war. All these things are out there that need addressing. We don't need this shrinking of democracy in some of the biggest countries in the world.
And on that note of taking on climate change, of course, you wrote notably Science Tales, which I think adds an interesting perspective from a point of view, like, let's be humble and think about the future of life, not just for humans, but for other life that we share this planet with. And you have a talent, I think, for, you know, bringing in nuance and complexity into something that's memorable and actionable. So what was your process in terms of writing Science Tales? Because that's a big story. So how do you bring it down to its essence?
What instigated that was that I was listening to a lot of science podcasts. And I noticed a small number of subjects that kept coming up that were not really understood by the general public. And these are always things that fascinate me. Why aren't these things properly understood? It was things like climate change, evolution, some of the alternative health medicines. So I want to take these one at a time and really look at them and explain it properly. So that book came out of that.
And so because you do have this strong element of telling nonfiction stories, I was wondering who those teachers and mentors were who influenced you to become a writer and artist. You know, why didn't you pursue a path of journalism? Was that something that you considered?
I was always going to be a drawing because I love drawing. You know, I was just always going to do that if I could get away with it. Really, I'm writing, again, just comes second nature to me. You're drawn to the things that you love, the things that you are good at. So I would never have been a journalist. I would have had to suppress certain parts of me. This brings all my talents together, if you like. So as for who influenced me, I started looking at the early sort of underground press of people like Robert Crumb, and these days people like John Porcellino, Hernandez Brothers, people who have really made the storytelling into a craft that you could do anything with.
What do you feel now? I mean, you know, AI is changing the way we engage with each other and our own imaginations. Also, fake news, but now it's like seeing is no longer believing because so many things are being shaken up. And it's also making incursions into the art world, into the writing world, where these things that took time. Now, some people think you could do it at the touch of a button. I don't believe that. I don't think it's the same thing at all. But I wonder what your reflections are on that.
it's far too early to say how it's going to shake out, really. A lot of it will come to nothing, like a lot of new technologies tend to do. Like VR came along and people thought, oh, that's going to be a real big thing. And it came to nothing ultimately. It became a niche thing for a few kinds of people. And I think AI might find a place ultimately when it falls out. But, you know, so ultimately that's going to trump any kind of mashing together all the stuff that already exists. So where's new things going to come from? It has to come from people. So I think people are going to start making choices. Are they going to be happy being given, or will it effectively be sort of processed, movies done with a few keywords, or will they be interested in hearing the actual voice of a human being? In the end, it's up to the audience out there, and that's us. What we pick, we will shape it.
Yeah, I think that people that grew up before its advent will have maybe a deeper or closer connection of what is real and what is artificial creativity. The only thing is that with very young people who are just coming up now, is that they grow up at the beginning of artificial intelligence and artificial creativity, so that their taste, I think, will be informed by that. So it'll be hard to tell the difference. I think it's interesting. I'll always veer toward the handmade, the things that take time. It's a bit like processed food. Some people can't tell the difference.
But that's not going to be everybody. I'm old enough to remember when, back in the 80s, when synthesizers became suddenly ubiquitous in popular music, and there was a real fear that actual real instruments would be completely replaced. I remember spokesmen for orchestras saying, oh, we're going to be out of a job. That didn't happen. What happened was the synthesizer became just another instrument the musicians used alongside other things. And I think something like that will happen ultimately to AI. It will become just another instrument or creative thing that artists will use in specific ways and could actually enhance things, not make things worse. I mean, we don't know how AI will be used to create in science. So it gives just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? We don't really know what's going to happen there. And the other thing I would say is that the media landscape, if you want to call it that, is almost uniformly negative. But underneath all this sort of dark stuff about Trump and Musk and Russia and Syria and Ukraine, there are actually a lot of good things going on, bubbling under. And any of those could blow up to be something really good in the future. We've got to keep a focus on the smaller things, really, to make sure that we can still be developing these things while we get through this very dark period, which won't last forever because nothing ever does.
Listening to Cunningham talk about his work, I was reminded of the long-standing relationship between comics and political commentary. In the United States alone, that relationship spans centuries, from the famous 1754 Join or Die snake cartoon urging the American colonies to unite, to Thomas Nast's ingenious depictions of corruption in the Gilded Age. These weren't just pictures. They were bold, visual manifestos, carving out a lexicon that defined political discourse. Today, that tradition lives on, but in new forms. Instagram posts fuse punchy captions with striking visuals, and TikTok transforms static imagery into dynamic soundtracked narratives. These platforms have become the new canvas for political storytelling. Much like the cartoons of the past, they challenge power and spark dialogue, reminding us that the pen, or now the screen, remains mightier than the sword. But while these new forms of political storytelling have their strengths, they also come at a cost. The speed of technological acceleration, what Jacques Derrida might call the relentless march of the techné, has reshaped how we engage with these visuals. Unlike the slower, deliberate pace of interpreting a political cartoon in a newspaper, today's posts and videos demand instant reactions. Scrolling, liking, and sharing replace reflection. The space for agency and interpretation shrinks as we respond in real time, pulled by algorithms into a cycle of passive consumption. In the process, we risk losing something crucial, the opportunity for democratic engagement. Without the interpretive space to question, debate, or challenge, we risk reducing the kinds of deliberation essential to democracy to a series of reactive gestures. So while the screen has taken up the mantle of the pen, it's worth asking, has its speed sharpened our understanding and deepened our engagement, or blunted them? Cunningham's comics offer an antidote. They refuse to settle for the quick, the easy, or the reactive, but demand something more: critical thought, engagement, and interpretation. If we want to reclaim the space for democratic dialogue, this is where we start. And now, back to the interview.
Yes. So I guess when you talk about hopeful things, you mentioned there, like things that you're wary of with AI, things that you're hopeful about in terms of science tales or in the environment. We've seen, like, just say in agriculture, there was all this industrialization of farming and fertilizers and insecticides and pesticides and all these things that poison us. But now there's a movement back, the regenerative agriculture, which is actually good for the planet, good for the soil, good for animals and for us. And also can draw down carbon in the atmosphere. So all these kind of things, and a good guarding against cancers and other. What were things that you were surprised about, that you're glad that we're making progress?
I think there's a lot of stuff happening in science, as you say, and you listed some of them there. But I think we should also not forget ourselves, what we can do on a personal level. And even if it's just in your local community, just having an allotment and growing flowers. I mean, I do baking, and we had people around the other day. And just sort of not forget, actually, that you're part of a community and that good things can happen there as well, and not get overwhelmed by the sort of dark things that are happening.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about teachers, but in terms of family or people who showed you that perhaps there was a place for you in the arts and to follow your dreams, you know, where did you get that kind of sense of support and community?
I'm very lucky to live in a small town called Wakefield in the north of England, and we have quite a strong art scene here, which I'm part of as well. So there are lots of artists here. There are artist studios in town, and there's a big gallery just down the road from us, the Hepworth, and they have big exhibitions there. So there's all stuff going on all the time. I always remember reading The Exorcist years ago, and one of the characters says, the devil is always advertising. You see signs of the devil everywhere, but God seems to be silent. And in this case, I think of good, really. The signs of evil always get the attention, but signs of good seem almost invisible. Yeah, they are there, and they're as strong and as binding and as powerful as anything else. I'm not a religious person in the traditional sense, and I may not believe in God as such, but I believe in good, believe in doing the right thing and making things better for people rather than worse.
Indeed. And you've also written psychiatric tales that kind of touched on your personal life. What drew you to finally write that?
So I worked for many years in mental health before I did what I do now. And very early when I was young, I struggled a bit with mental health issues in terms of depression and anxiety, that kind of thing. So I worked in mental health on an acute psychiatric ward for 6 or 7 years. And my book, Psychiatric Tales, came out of that experience because I wanted to write a book which would destroy a lot of the stigma that surrounds mental health, because people have a lot of fear of illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So I wrote a book which is broken up into different chapters, each one explaining a different mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. There's a chapter on self-harm, trying not to be judgmental and trying to be humane and trying to explain what perhaps the family of a sufferer experiences, as well as the professional people who care for those people, and ultimately the sufferers themselves. So yeah, that was my very first book, which came out from Bloomsbury in the US.
And it's a very important topic, and I think that we've seen now, fueled by social media and then COVID, because of isolation, some people didn't get the kind of care that they needed. I'm not sure, because I don't know how to measure these things, but people are sometimes suffering more. They're feeling things acutely that might be accelerated by the social media or different ways that things are amplified. We might have suffered them, but we had a sense of community. And now sometimes it doesn't give us ways to make sense of this accelerated new world we're living in.
Certainly, isolation is bad for our mental health. If we're suffering from any kind of mental health issue, isolation is going to exacerbate that. I think communities, family, friendship bonds, even work helps us bond with other people. We're social animals, and we need that social bonding to keep us going. I think that's the key to a good life, actually, a rich social life.
And for you personally, in those times of darkness, how did you deal with that? Or others around you, if they've experienced that, how is art a way through? You mentioned gardening and community and these different things. We all have moments, right? But how did you see the light at the end of these experiences?
That's a very good question. And it comes to a central thing which I'm often reflecting on, really, is how I got out. Because when I left working in the NHS, I suffered a couple of years of really quite severe depression. And I started writing the book, or a psychiatric tales drawing. I've always kept a diary through many years, and I started using the material that I'd collected in the diary as a basis for little strips, which were turned out to be the chapters of psychiatric tales. And this was sort of at the beginning of the 2000s, or a bit after that, when the internet was blooming, really, before it started to close down again. And I found by putting these online, I got a massive following. I never really took the book to publishers. They came to me because I had all these tens of thousands of followers. So it was, for me, it was that creative process of writing and drawing that brought me out of that darkness and created a kind of community that I could plug into. So there's a concrete example of how creativity can make you feel better, which I've experienced myself. I use my talent to help pull myself out of this pit of darkness I'd fallen into. That's quite a good image.
Yeah, I think it's really true. And I think, you know, in terms of the arts, I had a chance to interview Neil Gaiman. He's not a comic artist, but he's written, obviously, graphic novels that have been interpreted by the visual artists. But he said something, it's a nice way of thinking of the arts generally, but like a book is a dream that you hold in your hands. And I think that with an artwork, with a book, you can actually have that tangible contact with your dream, and you can hold it outside of yourself. You're creating a world and you can hand that to others. And so it creates a world in their life. So for me, it's just very positive that if we're lucky to work in the arts, we can have that connection. We're all born into this world with a creative capacity and with a sense of wonder. So it's a gift, I think.
Yeah, true. And I think we tend to think whatever problems we have are unique to us. What I found over and over again, that if I discuss any kind of issue that I have, I immediately find it's much more universal than I thought it was. You know, that thousands of people already experienced that. I'm working on a book about my adolescence, because I was in a children's home for a period back when I was a teenager. And so I thought I'd try and write about that experience. And I began to think, well, it's not that interesting, really. But I put little bits online through my Patreon and immediately got a very strong response of what I thought was quite a boring story. And actually, one of the readers wrote to me saying, well, yes, definitely you should continue with this because, you know, it's very like the way my own adolescence, and everyone thinks that their experience as an adolescent is unique to them. But of course, everyone struggles a little, and everyone can recognize that struggle.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I wonder, you've touched on it, but it's funny how you can, you know, come to a certain point in your life, like in the middle of your life, you can think, now is the time that I can look back.
I certainly had blocked that out for many. I didn't want to think about that. I didn't want it to be part of my identity, really. But there was a particular life event that happened, which has made me think about it. And that was my father died early in the year. And I'd started the process, I think, you know, subconsciously, I was sort of brewing on a lot of stuff that happened when I was younger and when he was younger as well.
You know, that's interesting. In the writing of, in the creating of art, we can come closer to our younger selves and maybe understand that in the reflection, but also we can, in some ways, understand our parents or the people that were mysterious that we can't, but in the art, we can come to understand them in a way because they become a character. And sometimes it's hard to hold reality still as you're experiencing it. But with the art, you can relive it and have those deep reflections. And so I guess that in the writing of what you're working out now in this book, you can continue the conversation with your father.
It's a way of understanding my parents a little better. Trying to, because as you were a kid, you're so wrapped up in your own problems. You don't even think that your parents are got their own struggles, or you don't even give them any thought whatsoever. I mean, children are essentially quite selfish, but they kind of have to be. But as you get older, you broaden out and you think, well, now I can see a bigger picture. I was just a part of that picture, not the whole thing.
Yeah, we're all just trying to, I think it only comes maybe at the end of our life sometimes. Like it only just the pieces kind of fall together towards the end, you know. We get like glimpses through a gauze or something, but we only kind of figure it out at the end. And I think that's sort of how we're kind of meant to be. We shouldn't know it all when we're born. We kind of learn along the way, remember what we once knew, I guess, if you think about it a different way, along the way. I'm wondering what you were like as a young person.
I was incredibly shy and withdrawn, really. I struggled to fit in with other children, and I found school a hellish experience because of my social anxiety, really, and that led me to basically try and stay off school. I would basically wander the town and the local countryside and not go. I got me into a lot of trouble. And that was one of the reasons I was sent to this children's home, which was for children who had sort of mental health difficulties, although I didn't see it that way at the time. I thought I was being punished, basically. It was a good experience in many ways because I met a lot of other kids, took us out, and we did all sorts of trips and stuff like that. There were also dark things about that. I mean, I was fine, but a year after that, one of the children there was abused by one of the people who worked there. That was not all the staff that worked there. It was just one person of the 20 or so people who worked there who were, generally speaking, the most caring people you can imagine. I think things are a lot better now than they were. There's obviously very careful checks on who works with children. It wasn't really thought about too much in the 70s.
Yeah, there were so many things at that time when we didn't question things. You were talking about being sent to this school. You write about Elon Musk, and he has his autism spectrum. And, you know, at that time, when you're talking about, I think people would be pigeonholed that they were just too different. There was something wrong. And you also wrote in terms of him that he was bullied and, you know, the different experiences. So I'm glad that that's opened up. We have an appreciation for the different gifts people have. And I'm so glad that you found writing and art, because that's a definite gift that helps us see our way through. But, you know, we don't only learn in one way. There's so many different ways of seeing the world.
Indeed. I mean, coming back to Elon Musk again, I think reading between that, he won't speak about his relationship with his father. None of his children has ever seen their grandfather. So there was an abusive relationship there. The nature of it was unknown, really. It can't really be commented on directly. But I feel that he's a man who has been sort of damaged by that, and is sort of, to some extent, still working kind of those ideas out, really. Unfortunately, he hasn't reached the light yet, and we've seen in a lot of darkness in his personality. That is unfortunate, not just for him, but for the rest of us.
Is there something in your research about Elon Musk or these other personalities, these people that seek to dominate their environments or the world, like Putin, these other billionaires, certain political figures, or Murdoch? What unites them to want to be excellent, to want to dominate? What were the kind of precursors that led, like if you see obvious through lines to who they became?
No one should really be a billionaire, because it's damaging as to the country that they're in, that they have so much wealth, because they have so much wealth that they then immediately have enormous political power, which is undemocratic. So they should really be sitting on wealth. I have nothing against people becoming millionaires or even multimillionaires. Let's go out and be rich if you want to be. But multibillionaires, that is incredibly bad for all of us. As we've seen, if you have so much money that you can effectively buy an entire political party, then obviously that's a thing that shouldn't exist.
Yes, and I think that that's a good kind of note to end on, just as you did in your book on Elon Musk. You mentioned the recent Oxfam report that predicted that the very richest are currently enlarging their fortunes. The world could have its first ever trillionaire in just 10 years. And the fortunes of the five richest men have shot up by 14% since 2020. People worldwide are working harder and longer hours for poverty wages across the world, unsafe jobs. So given all of this, the power to do good. I think that there are billionaires or multimillionaires anyway that are motivated to do good. But given, you know, these kind of stark facts and the concentration of wealth as it is, deepening inequities, what then gives you hope? What gives you that sense of optimism where we're seeing some kind of progress, and how can we do better?
It's really difficult to say how this will end. I would like to think that it will end. Well, I'm in my 60s now, live in the UK. So when I grew up, the Northern Ireland situation seemed unsolvable. What was happening in South Africa with apartheid seemed unsolvable. And you just assumed that there would be terrorism in Northern Ireland and across the UK forever. You never thought it would come to an end. But of course it did come to an end. And there's been peace in Northern Ireland ever since. And when you look back, you realise it was inevitable that that was going to happen, because eventually everybody was going to get tired of that. So I like to think that sometimes out of nowhere, change can come. And when you look back, you realise, well, it was inevitable that was going to happen, because all these forces underneath, they were pushing, that we didn't see, but they were there. This is why we have to keep remain hopeful, really, because that too is part of that process. I live in Wakefield, and what I like about this town is it's big enough to be just about a city, but just outside there are some beautiful countryside, beautiful paths, and there is a lake system not far from us, and a sort of ruins of a castle look down a valley to these lakes and the fence. You're so beautiful.
The true things sometimes are. So thank you, Daryl Cunningham, for sharing your purpose and shining a light on these important issues, and for all you do, make complex subjects accessible to a wider audience. By bearing witness, you help us understand that we can create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. I very much enjoyed this conversation.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Virginia Moschetti. The Creative Process podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.